That's Lee Morgan on trumpet opening up on Midtown Blues. It's from his 1960 album, Leeway. Also featured on this album, Jackie McLean on alto sax, Bobby Timmons on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Art Blakey on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, July the 16th, 2015. And we'll be talking about world money woes, bankruptcies, bailouts, and big trade boondoggles. Diplomatic scholar, historian, attorney, and prolific author Dr. Gerald Horn joins us today to take a look at major trade issues and the corresponding shifts in global power, and the impact of these factors on U.S. foreign and domestic policy. Dr. Horn is no stranger to this program. He is the John J. and Rebecca Moores Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He also teaches graduate courses in diplomatic history and has written more than 30 books, more than 100 scholarly papers and reviews on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. His latest books are Race to Revolution, The U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, and one of my favorites, and I highly recommend it. I recommend all of Dr. Horn's works to you. But this one was the focus of great study here and discussion, and including recently, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance, and the Origins of the United States of America. Thanks, Gerald, for being with us today. Always a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and let me add a quick footnote. I'm speaking to you from the Institute of Jazz Studies in Newark, and I'm doing a new book on jazz and organized crime and violence, and I was just reading about Lee Morgan and how he was cheated by Roulette Records and Morris Levy, who will figure in this book, and Jackie McLean as well, and his conflictual relationship with Bob Weinstock of Prestige Records and how he was cheated as well. It's quite a story.
Oh my. So you're a one-stop shop. We can talk history, we can talk economics, we can talk contemporary politics, and we could talk jazz, and we could talk jazz and crime.
Oh, yes. I mean, I have to say that, like some people who are more interested in what I'm working on now than what I've done in the past, and so my mind is overflowing with this project about jazz and not only organized crime, but the impact on contemporary culture.
Mm-hmm. It's great. I look forward to it. Well, let's get started with where you think things are headed with two very, very controversial bankruptcies, and that involves the island of Puerto Rico, the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, and Greece. What do you see as the connection between the two, and what do you think is the most significant thing about these two crises?
Well, I think the bell tolls for thee, for whom the bell tolls for thee, as the poet John Donne wrote some centuries ago. What I mean is that I think that Greece and Puerto Rico are taking arrows in the chest. These are demonstration projects. What's happening is that you oftentimes have to beat one slave to keep the entire plantation in line. And just like Greece has been forced into these austerity measures that involve raising of the retirement age and cutbacks and pension benefits and all the rest, there's no doubt that there are those in Washington and on Wall Street who would like to get their grubby paws on Social Security, who would like to cut back on Medicare and Medicaid, and who would like to impose a punishing austerity on all of us. And likewise, with regard to Puerto Rico, a similar process is unfolding. I'm sure you know that there are more Puerto Ricans residing on the North American mainland and then on the island, and that disproportion is going to increase with the austerity that's now being forced down the throats Puerto Ricans. Already, there were articles recently about certain communities on the island that are running out of water, believe it or not. I'm not sure what that's going to mean. But in any case, Greece, in many ways, is the more dire situation. I say that because many of us had very high hopes for the ruling party, Syriza, when it came into power approximately 6 months ago. And I have been reluctant to criticize Syriza publicly because, to me, up until recently, I felt that they deserve and merit solidarity, and that in the middle of a battle, you don't necessarily start issuing memos or criticizing those who are in the leadership of a struggle. But some of the moves that have been taken lately by that party, I'm sort of befuddled by. I mean, for example, take the referendum that was held 7 or 8 days ago, where the Greek electorate voted 60-40 to reject heightened austerity. And then the leadership turned around and fundamentally turned their backs on that referendum and accept austerity. Now, Tsipras, the prime minister, has said that he had no choice. And I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. But then the question is, well, then why hold this referendum, which you told people to vote against and they followed you, and now you're accepting an austerity package that's harsher than the original terms that were proposed by the Troika, the European Commission in Brussels, the European Central Bank in Germany, and, of course, the International Monetary Fund headquartered in Washington. Now, in the public statements I've made about the Greek situation, I tried to stress the dire odds that this country of 11 or 12 million face in an international environment that's not necessarily conducive to progressive struggle. It's not like Cuba, an island nation of a similar population. After its revolution in 1959, it had the backing of the socialist camp. There was a different international environment that was fueled by national liberation movements, not least in Africa, and that allowed Cuba to survive even after the socialist camp disappeared. But now, that's not the kind of situation that Greece faces. In fact, one of the curious aspects of the entire Greek crisis is that these Eastern European countries and Baltic republics that were formerly socialist have been, along with Germany, the most hawkish with regard to the imposition of austerity. And it seems to me that the U.S. left, which played such a useful role in helping to push some of these now hawkish right-wing forces into power in places like Slovakia, for example, should take a bit of ownership of this crisis because they pushed these people into power, and now they're beating up on Greece, and Greece is going to be the model for the United States, which means in many ways our friends on the left helped to create a situation that's going to come back and bite us in the butt. And another reason why I've decided to speak more publicly in a critical fashion about Syriza, which is fundamentally not my style to criticize other forces on the left in this manner, is that I see a kind of parallel with the catastrophe that's unfolding in Greece that the leadership of Syriza has helped to engineer, and some of our friends on the left in the United States. I mean, look at Wisconsin, for example. Recall just a few years ago, our friends on the left in Wisconsin were telling us that we need to recall Governor Scott Walker. And we marched to the polls, and of course he won a resounding victory and is now one of the leading candidates in the Republican Party to become the next president of the United States. So in other words, the left helped to create Scott Walker, and they helped to do it because, unlike a wise general who surveys the battlefield before charging into battle and does not necessarily see charging into battle and advancing as the only way to go, some of our friends on the left feel that as long as you have the correct line, which is that Scott Walker, which he is a dope and a right-wing traducer, then you should move forward to get rid of him, irrespective of what the white working class thinks about him, which obviously he had a good deal of support in the white working class and the white middle class, and perhaps the method should have been to try to educate those folks. And likewise, it seems to me that Syriza hasn't necessarily taken to account the dire international situation, or alternatively try to work out a diplomatic strategy that would involve appeals to Moscow, appeals to Beijing, appeals to the BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and trying to take advantage of the contradictions that exist between the BRICS and the North Atlantic countries. So it's a very unfortunate situation that's unfolding. But as I said, the bell tolls for thee. I mean, it's not just the Greek working class, the Greek middle class, who are going to be punished and pulverized as a result of this crisis, because we're next for the chopping block.
I wanted to get to this question about economic theory. We talked yesterday with Mauro Guillen of Wharton about the debt crisis in Puerto Rico. And on a theoretical level, it had to do with what is the theory that drives this concept of emerging economies in the way that Puerto Rico was thought of as an emerging economy, and consequently, what also breaks emerging economies. But in the case of Greece, we had, at least ostensibly, it appeared that we had a leftist economic theory undergirding Greece's position, that in the form of Yanis Varoufakis, who has since left the Tsipras administration. Is this also the situation of Greece's debt crisis also a test? And is this where the line of demarcation is, the fault line is, that in as much, although it is, of course, an economic issue, it is also an ideological issue, and perhaps the hard line against Greece is about tempering this ideological zeal that Greece would have come to represent, you know, as a prototypical resurgence of leftist global action. Do you see any ideological fault lines here that may account for the forceful opposition to Greece's Marxist-leaning economic theories that were undergirding its position about debt and debt relief?
Oh, sure. Let me go back to my analogy of beating one slave to keep the entire plantation in line. What I mean is that after Greece, there comes Spain, where the Podemos party, the We Can party, which is a similarly left-wing oriented party, has been doing quite well in the polls. We all know that there are similar debt problems in France, where the left traditionally has been quite strong, not to mention in Italy, where the left traditionally has been quite strong. And it was felt that a hard line had to be taken against Greece, lest the idea is floated that Podemos and other left-wing parties can act in a similar anti-austerity manner. Fundamentally, this is a struggle about politics and economics. That is to say, it's a struggle about whether left-wing forces that represent the poor and working class and certain sectors of the middle class can claim a larger share of the national income than the local elite and the global and European elite. And thus far, the latter seems to be surging. But I dare say that I think this is going to backfire on Germany and the European Union. For example, Britain is going to be holding a referendum sooner or later as to whether or not to stay within the European Union. After the beatdown that Greece has taken, I believe that many progressive and left-wing and liberal forces will probably be pushing for Britain to leave the European Union. Likewise, with regard to Scotland, the theory of Scottish independence and pulling out of the United Kingdom rested upon the fact that they could just as well get aid from Brussels, that is to say, the capital of the European Union, as they could from London, the capital of the United Kingdom. But I'm sure that in Glasgow and in Edinburgh, there are sober reconsiderations of the idea of seceding from the United Kingdom and then entering into the diktat of Germany. I think it's also interesting to note the reaction of Washington. On the one hand, as noted, there are those in Washington who feel that Theresa should be given an appropriate and proper rebuff, lest that the left-wing forces of the United States come to the conclusion that they can emulate Theresa. But at the same time, I think that there is also an opinion in Washington that is not necessarily supportive of this hard line that Brussels, and particularly Berlin, are taking towards Athens. That is to say, you see this reflected in the International Monetary Fund recent memorandum. The IMF, of course, is headquartered in Washington and is under the thumb of the United States and is one of the major interlocutors in this Greek crisis and is one of the major creditors of Greece, where it basically said that the Troika, the IMF, the European Commission in Brussels, and the European Central Bank headquartered in Germany, should be pushing more towards a debt relief, and that not pushing towards a debt relief and just pushing this mindless austerity is a no-win proposition. And I think that that reflects a larger geostrategic view in Washington, which is that Greece is being punished and pulverized so severely that even though it seems as if the left is on the defensive and retreating and the right wing has the upper hand, there is a danger of a backlash and that Greece might decide to follow the advice I just proffered on your program, which is turning towards Moscow and turning towards Beijing. And Greece is not only a member of the European Union, it guards the southeastern flank of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which, by the way, is in the process of holding one of the largest military maneuvers in its history, supposedly guarding against thrust across the Mediterranean from the so-called Islamic State. And this is holding other maneuvers just recently that were targeting Moscow. So Greece has a very important geostrategic location, and there is a fear among some in Washington that pushing Greece to the wall, which is what is happening now, could really backfire big time. And I think that that is a supposition that should be considered carefully.
Do you see, you're right against racism a lot, and you deal with this issue in a straightforward fashion. I want to ask, it's a delicate question because it is not an overt statement of racism, but one can't help but notice a particular parallel between Puerto Rico and Greece in this regard, and in the terms of how these two countries are regarded within the communities that they allegedly belong. And in the case of Greece, is there a feeling that you get that one of the factors in the way that the European Union is dealing with Greece has to do with the fact that the Greeks really aren't European. They aren't really white people, and they're getting the treatment. In other words, that Puerto Rico, for example, is not a real American, white American country, and therefore you could play faster and looser with the rules. Do you get that kind of a feeling? I get the feeling that there's a hint of it in the way that Greece is treated by the European members, as if it's second tier or third tier a country by virtue of the racial connotations within who is a real European.
Well, I think you're onto something. It reminds me of the current crisis in the United States about mass incarceration that disproportionately afflicts people of African descent in the first place. It's the third stage in our long journey in North America from slavery to Jim Crow and now to mass incarceration. And it also afflicts the colonized people, that is to say, people of Puerto Rican descent and Mexican descent in the first place. But we also know that racism and bigotry is not necessarily akin to an anesthetic that can be localized. That is to say, you can just localize this against black and brown people and everybody else escapes, because we all know that there is, in terms of this U.S. prison population that's probably the largest in the world, there are a considerable number behind bars that can be defined as, quote, white, unquote. And likewise, with regard to racism, which you've seen skyrocket in Europe, with the refugee crisis, which of course was fueled by the boneheaded decision in 2011 to overthrow the regime in Tripoli, Libya, which has opened that country to be a gateway for migrants, particularly from Africa, streaming from all parts of Africa, through Niger, through Mali, and upwards into Libya, Tripoli, and then across the Mediterranean. And of course, they're screaming into Greece, too, from Afghanistan and from Syria, et cetera. And this has led to a tidal wave of racism being unleashed in the European Union. Implanted in my mind's eye is a picture in the New York Times from a few days ago from a demonstration in Bratislava in Slovakia with the placard held prominently saying, Slovakia is not Africa, because there was pressure on all the EU countries to take a quota of refugees, not only from Africa, but certainly quite a few from Africa. And this was engendering a real racist backlash. And likewise, even before this refugee crisis, there was this split in the European Union that many thought would lead to a split in the common currency, that is to say the euro, between Noro and Asuro, a northern European euro and a southern European euro. That is to say, you get this idea from countries like Finland and Germany and the Netherlands in northern Europe that somehow they're the hard workers in Mitt Romney's 2012 comment. They're part of the makers, and the people in southern Europe, like Greece, are the takers. The people in southern Europe are the moochers. And certainly there's a kind of bigoted reaction to Athens that we cannot discard or we cannot easily dismiss. But the problem is that there's not only a possibility of this leading to a further push to the right, a further push to the left. We also know that in Greece there's a rather formidable right-wing movement, the Golden Dawn movement, which marches under the banner of Greece for the Greeks and has been attacking dark-skinned people in the streets. As you may know, over the years, there's been a significant migration, believe it or not, of Black Americans into Athens, some of whom are holding positions of influence, and some of them have become under attack in Athens as well. And the way politics is going in Greece right now, with this mindless austerity being implanted, as noted, there's not only a danger of a surge to the left, there's a real danger of a surge to the right, fueled by this chauvinism and racism and bigotry that's now suffusing Europe.
The 7th BRICS summit just concluded. It was held between July 8th and 9th in the Russian city of Ufa. And obviously, there were some very, very significant outcomes there from that summit. What would you say were the some of the noteworthy outcomes of the 7th BRICS summit?
Well, it was not only the seventh BRICS summit that was held in Russia. Alongside that was the meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which in many ways is spearheaded by Moscow, followed by Beijing, and is seen as a counterpart to NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And you saw the participation in the SCO of India and Pakistan, and it's hoped that as a result of their participating, those two countries that have fought numerous wars against each other since independence in 1947, that there will be some sort of reconciliation and accord between the two, although that may be too much to hope for, but we can still hope. But with regard to the BRICS, I think you see a further consolidation of a new international architecture that will be challenging the World Bank headquartered in Washington and International Monetary Fund headquartered in Washington. Of course, the World Bank has a de facto charter that suggests that the leadership should always be a U.S. national, which it is, and that the IMF should always be led by a European, which, of course, it is, Christine Lagarde of France. And there has been a measure in Congress languishing for some time to readjust the voting strength of these two institutions to reflect the rise of China and India and the other BRICS nations. But of course, the Republican Congress has resisted the readjustment of voting power, and therefore China, India, and the other members of the BRICS feel they have no alternative but to build an alternative structure. And so you see China sponsoring an Asian industrial investment bank that will be sponsoring the building of infrastructure throughout Asia in particular that the United States objected to, but that did not keep Australia and Britain and other ostensible U.S. allies from signing on to that institution. You see a BRICS bank that's evolving and developing that will be challenging the hegemony of the World Bank with regard to building of infrastructure worldwide, that is to say bridges, roads, airports, and all the rest. And you also see steps towards challenging the International Monetary Fund. Now, it's interesting that just as the BRICS and the SCO were meeting, China was undergoing a very severe drop in the Shanghai stock market that, but for the Greece crisis, would have been the number one headline. I mean, since mid-June, the Shanghai stock market has shed billions, if not trillions, that's trillions of dollars of value. And yet, despite that sharp drop, if you look over the past year up until this very day, the Shanghai stock market is still up. That is to say, if you had invested last year, you would still have been making money today, even though since mid-June there's been this sharp drop. Now, that's something to be contemplated because it suggests that there may be problems in this otherwise soaring Chinese economy that some may not have noted sufficiently. You might have also noted that just last week, just a few days ago, as the BRICS summit was convening in Russia and as the Shanghai Cooperation Summit was convening in Russia, the leader not of the Vietnamese state, not of the Vietnamese government, but of the Vietnamese Communist Party was meeting in the White House with U.S. President Barack Obama. Now, this is obviously part of Washington's policy of encirclement of China. You know, of course, about the decision today that's being voted on in Tokyo that would strengthen the Japanese military, which is also part of that encirclement. And a few years ago, President Obama himself traveled to Northern Australia to establish a U.S. military base there, also part of that encirclement. And Vietnam is also part of that encirclement. And India, which is China's partner in BRICS, but fought a very bloody war with China in 1962, is also part of that encirclement. And so this was a very curious visit by the leader of the Vietnamese Communist Party at that particular moment. But one has to be somewhat sympathetic to Vietnam because we know that the beginning of China's ascension as a great economic power can basically be marked from 1979 when then paramount leader Deng Xiaoping visited the United States, donned a 10-gallon Texas cowboy hat in Houston and at a rodeo and visited with U.S. President Jimmy Carter and made a decision there to go back and attack Vietnam, which he did almost from landing in Beijing. And as a part of the payoff, there was this massive foreign direct investment into China that's created this juggernaut. And so now it seems that Vietnam is trying to repay the favor. Vietnam, of course, will be part of the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership that excludes China and is also part of this encirclement policy of China. I should also mention in that regard that there's a new novel by Peter Singer called Ghost Fleet that's climbing the bestseller charts in the United States of America, a fictionalized account of World War III between the United States and China, fought in the Pacific. And of course, those in your listening audience on the West Coast of the United States should recognize that if that nightmare scenario somehow comes to fruition, they will not escape unscathed. But this is part of the U.S. counterreaction to not only the rise of China, but the rise of the BRICS, of which China is a constituent element.
Well, there is no question that the BRICS organization is bona fide and doing exceedingly well by every single measure. In fact, posing, as the Obama administration would see it, a direct threat to U.S. hegemony. From the Russia and India report filed just yesterday, I read that China used more cement in the past 3 years than the United States has used in the entire 20th century. And I mean, this is the rate of growth. Bloomberg is reporting that the combined economic output last year of the BRICS nations almost matched America's GDP. What is significant about that is that just 8 years ago, the U.S. economy was double the size, that of BRICS. Again, just to give a sense of how rapid the growth is and how just staggering the accumulated wealth and the, of course, the implied political position is with the BRICS group as opposed to our normal U.S. hegemony. It is the BRICS nations have really solidified themselves to the point, according to the report, that the prediction is that the Chinese economies would overtake. Initially, the prediction was that the Chinese economies would overtake the U.S. by 2040 or 2060. And now that has been revised to 2020. So there is a dramatic and a monumental building of resources. How do you see the Obama administration reacting to this? And how is this likely to impact the realignment, political realignment globally?
Well, you may know, I'm sure, that the Financial Times in London and the International Monetary Fund in 2014 said that by certain measures, the Chinese economy had already surpassed the size of the U.S. economy. The late Nobel laureate, Robert Fogel of the University of Chicago, said that by 2040, it's possible that the Chinese economy might be 4 to 5 to 6 or more times larger than the U.S. economy. I just made reference to the sharp drop-off in the Shanghai stock market, and yet the fact remains that China holds by an order of magnitude more foreign currency than any other country, approaching $4 trillion. Keep in mind that the U.S. economy, the collective assets held in the United States, is about $17.5 trillion. So this gives you an idea of what is now being contemplated and what is now being faced. And I may have said before, but bears repeating, that I don't think you can understand the attempt by the Barack Obama White House to normalize relations with Cuba without understanding this new geopolitical situation where China is now being seen as a major challenger to U.S. hegemony. That is to say that during the Cold War in October 1962, you recall the Cuban Missile Crisis, so-called, where in a standoff between Moscow and Washington, Moscow had placed missiles in Cuba that were said to challenge and threaten the United States' national security and almost led the world to the brink of nuclear destruction. Well, since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, China-Cuba relations have improved significantly to the point where, in my estimation, one of the reasons why President Obama was moving towards normalizing was to forestall the possibility of another kind of missile standoff, but this time with Chinese missiles. I should also mention in this context that the Russian bombers have been spotted off the coast of California, off the coast of the Gulf of Mexico. And what that really exposes is the real fault lines in U.S. grand strategy, so-called, as they call it in Wall Street and in Washington think tanks and all the rest, in order to develop a grand strategy, that is to say a strategy that will guarantee U.S. hegemony and domination for the foreseeable future, you have to decide what the main challenger is. And I said challenger, singular. But right now, the U.S. ruling elite is split because Mitt Romney in 2012 and Joe Dunford, the newly about to be installed leader of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the top U.S. soldier, have said that Russia is the main challenger to U.S. hegemony, even though it's a country of 150 million, the United States has 320 million, despite the fact that John McCain says that Russia is basically a gas station masquerading as a big power, a jocular attempt to downgrade Russia and reduce it to its major export, which is oil and petroleum. But at the same time, you have other forces in the U.S. ruling elite who see China as a major threat, given all these figures we've just been citing ad infinitum with regard to its foreign currency holdings, with regard to the size of its economy and all the rest. And so because there is a difficulty in deciding who the main antagonist is, it's difficult to come up with a coherent strategy. And that's not even talking about the rise of the Islamic State, which is also something that President Obama has said the United States has to focus on. And my estimation is part of the underlying force that has driven this new proposed nuclear accord with Iran. So it's clear that the nations of the world are not sitting idly by as China is rising. It's clear, for example, that African nations are moving closer to Beijing. That's been a subject of much discussion and much debate, as I'm sure you know. And the same holds true for the Latin American nations and for Asian nations who are also being drawn into the Chinese orbit. So the old saying is, may you live in interesting times. And I think that's an apt description of what we're facing at this precise moment.
Well, here's a question, again, an ideological question. China and Russia having their own ideologies that are quite different from those of the United States and the West, but adopting what it appears to be very aggressive capitalistic tactics in building their version of dominance and control of the global market. Do you see any suggestion at all that this is a concern in Russia and in China, that these countries in some ways have had to bow to the requirements of capitalism, if you will, in order to succeed and in order to dominate? And have they already traded in or made that trade, that they will trade off the ideological idealism for capitalistic pragmatism?
Well, it's very curious. During the Cold War, fundamentally, the United States, particularly under President Reagan, threatened to blow up the entire world, particularly threatened to blow up the then Soviet Union, unless it dropped its version of socialism and emulated the United States and allowed private interests to run amok and reign supreme. And on December 21st, 1991, the Soviet Union dissolved. The United States declared that it had won the Cold War. There were those who were saying rather loudly and shouting from the rooftops, in fact, that this basically showed the success of the U.S. model of development, and that the United States was the indispensable nation and would be dominant and hegemonic forevermore. But as we've just talked about in our last exchange, this doesn't seem to be working out that way. Not least if you look at how China is developing. And I think for those of us who have an interest in African affairs, this is also very curious because, I mean, if you look at Angola, you know that after independence in 1975, this nation in Southwest Africa, and of course we know that a significant percentage of those now defined as African-American are actually Angolan descent.
ironically and curiously validated by the fact that the leading prison in the state of Louisiana is called Angola State Prison, which is heavily populated, curiously enough, by African Americans who are probably Angolan themselves. That's, to me, one of the more curious aspects of U.S. reality. But Angola had tried to embark on a path of socialism in the United States, fundamentally funded a rebel group called UNITA and the National Union for the Total Independence of Angola, so-called, under General Savimbi, that conducted a terror campaign against Angola until it was forced to cry uncle, calling Cuban troops, who then helped to invade, or who helped to repel an invasion from apartheid South Africa to help UNITA. And then, of course, after that threat was attended to, Angola had had enough and decided that it didn't want to face another terrorist threat from the United States. And so now it's embarked on a path of private ownership of the means of production. And so now you have columnists like Nick Kristof of the New York Times who go to Angola and wring their hands about the disparities in wealth in Angola and the number of poor children in Angola, all of which is true, without making any reference to this past history as to why and how Angola had tried to embark on a path of sharing the wealth produced by diamond mines and one of the major oil-producing nations on planet Earth. But the United States said, no, you know, we're going to fund terrorists until you give up this idea of sharing the wealth. And now, of course, with the typical definition of journalists as those who go into the battlefield and shoot the wounded, you have Nick Kristof going into Angola complaining about Angola today. Well, where was he 25 years ago? And the same thing holds true for Mozambique, which celebrated its independence in June 1975. And also under Frelimo, it tried to embark on a socialist path of sharing the wealth. The United States and its allies sponsored terrorist groups led by the so-called Mozambique National Resistance until they cried uncle. You might recall that in 1986, the apartheid South African authorities even assassinated the founding father of Mozambique and then leader, Samora Machel, by driving his airplane through the manipulation of radar and beacons into a mountain and killing the entire leadership of the country. And so now they, too, have to embark on the path of private development. And now you read less about Mozambique because it's not seen as a threat to U.S. national security because it's not pursuing socialism. But with all of that bloodshed and all of that terror, it's quite curious that you see that the United States' dreams after December 25th, 1991, of being hegemonic and dominant forevermore after the collapse of the Soviet Union, those dreams are turning to ash. And even though that there is significant private investment in China, the fact of the matter is the commanding heights of the Chinese economy are still dominated by state-owned firms that are quite flush with cash. You might have been reading the headlines about a Chinese state-owned firm that's trying to purchase Micron, which is a crown jewel of the U.S. scientific and technological revolution based in Cincinnati. And I doubt if the U.S. authorities will allow that purchase to go through, but the fact that they can put cash on the barrelhead by this crown jewel says quite a bit. And so it's quite curious that after spending trillions of dollars and threatening to blow up the world, blow up the Soviet Union, sponsoring wars in Africa and elsewhere to establish U.S. hegemony, the fact of the matter is that that hegemony is rapidly declining.
Well, considering that President Obama is going to be going to Africa, East Africa specifically, next week, what would his visit mean for U.S. hegemony? Just to follow up on your last interchange.
Well, quite frankly, and I mean this in all seriousness, I hope that Mr. Obama's security team is competent, because you may recall that Al-Shabaab, which is headquartered in neighboring Somalia, has been on the warpath lately. I'm sure you recall the stories of months ago of them attacking the shopping center in downtown Nairobi, of them attacking a college in Kenya. And they have promised and pledged to make a difficult make sure that Mr. Obama has a very difficult trip to his father's homeland. And if you believe Donald Trump, Mr. Obama's homeland as well. So this is going to be a very interesting trip. He's also going to Ethiopia, Addis Ababa, the headquarters of the African Union, which will allow him to meet with a number of leading African personalities. I might say that he's flying once again into a region in turmoil just across the Red Sea. In Yemen, we know about the Saudi attacks on Yemen that has driven that country into the ditch. Due north in the Sinai Peninsula, part of Egypt, the so-called Islamic State has been fighting pitched battles with the Egyptian military, with the Egyptian military having to call in airstrikes, having to deploy battalions against the so-called Islamic State. But in the larger scheme of things, part of the purpose of Mr. Obama's trip to East Africa is to once again try to ensure that there is a challenger to Chinese and BRICS influence in that part of Africa. I say BRICS influence as well, because Brazil also has been quite active in Africa of late, not only in Angola in Southwest Africa, and of course a significant percentage of the Africans in Angola, the Africans in Brazil have Angolan roots, thanks to U.S. slave dealers who in the 1830s and the 1840s began sailing into Angola and handcuffing and manacling Africans with the maniacal energy of crazed bees and dragging them across the Atlantic, kicking and screaming, to work in coffee plantations and donate their labor for free. And the same holds true from Mozambique, due south from where Mr. Obama will be landing in Nairobi and in Addis Ababa. But now, as noted, China has been investing quite heavily in both Eastern and Western Africa as the major trading partner, for example, of Angola. And I'm not sure if Mr. Obama will be able to successfully counter that Chinese initiative, because it was over two decades ago that then U.S. President George H.W. Bush said the United States had more will than wallet. And I can't say that the U.S. economic profile has improved considerably since he was president some 25-odd years ago.
What do you think that the president will come out with? Do you think that he would come out with anything meaty enough to suggest that his promise to engage with Africa on matters of trade and on matters of democracy and so forth, but particularly trade, since we're talking trade heavily today, do you think that Obama's trip in any way would yield a significant, as they say, pivot, trade pivot toward African nations?
Well, recall that when there was that summit between African leaders in Washington, basically orchestrated by President Obama, one of the initiatives that came out of that was this power initiative that in many ways would be a boon for GE or General Electric. The chairman of General Electric, Jeffrey Immelt, is one of the few corporate titans who has been perceived as being close to the White House. And GE, funded in part by the U.S. government, would be helping African nations to move more aggressively towards complete electrification. I was just reading an article the other day in the Financial Times about Channels TV, which is headquartered in Lagos, Nigeria, and is a challenger to Al Jazeera and to RT in Moscow and CCTV in Beijing and Telesur in Caracas, Venezuela, and CNN in the United States of America and BBC. And it broadcast to an international audience, but of course heavily watched by the large Nigerian diaspora, which of course is heavily concentrated in places like Houston, Texas, and in New York City. And the leader of Channels TV was saying that because of spotty electricity in Lagos, where they broadcast from, they have to use their own generators and oftentimes spend $750,000 a year just to keep electricity going so they can continue to broadcast. And that's just one enterprise in what is now Africa's largest economy. Likewise, in South Africa, which in many ways is the continent's giant, Nigeria notwithstanding, they too have a significant problem with electricity. So I would hope that this initiative, this power initiative between Washington and GE that promises to help bring more advanced electrification to Africa, is not just a flash in the pan, because it's something that is desperately needed, because it's difficult to see how industry can take flight if electricity is spotty. Likewise, Facebook, the U.S.-based entity headquartered in Menlo Park, California, has been promising through its charitable arm to try to improve the internet capability of Africa. I hope that they carry through on that promise, because that would be quite useful in terms of education. That is to say, it's quite useful to students to have access to the internet, needless to say. And likewise, there are efforts to lay cables to allow for the internet, cables heading northward from South Africa, up the eastern and western coast of Africa. I would hope that Mr. Obama would have something to say about that and would also put some money on the table with regard to that. But once again, I'm not sure if the United States has either the will or the wallet, even in conjunction with major entities like Facebook and GE, to carry through on these kinds of plans and proposals.
As we close, I just wanted to ask your opinion about the role of the African Union here and how it might interact with the president's visit. Has the African Union, in your view, articulated a cogent plan of any sort, especially with respect to trade and the U.S.?
Well, keep in mind that just a few weeks ago in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, there was a meeting of 26 African nations, which is about half of the member states of the African Union, that pledged to try to have a kind of merger of their economies, not unlike what you see unfolding in the European Union, to have a market from the Cape to Cairo, where there would be a possibility not only of free movement of goods, but also free movement of capital as well.
And people.
That is, sorry?
And people. That was the thing, an integrated
yes.
plan.
Yes, capital, goods, and labor. Now, we'll see if that is executed, because in Southern Africa, for example, you have the SADC, the Southern African Development Community, and one would have to wonder if SADC could fit into that Sharm el-Sheikh plan. And then you have COMESA, which is the Eastern African nations stretching down to Southern Africa, and whether or not they could fit into that plan as well. My own axe to grind, or point of personal privilege, if you like, with regard to the African Union, I was telling a reporter of the United Nations just a few days ago that I would hope that the African Union would use its good offices to raise the question of humanitarian intervention in the United States to do something about the spate of police killings in Baltimore and Cleveland and Ferguson and Gardena, California, and all of these other tortured sites, Staten Island, New York, with Eric Garner, because this has reached epidemic proportions. We obviously need some sort of international assistance, and the African Union is in a very unique position to do something about this, at least to raise it in their conversations with Barack Obama when he lands in Addis Ababa, because we know that historically, for black people in particular, for progressive movement in general, because the United States has been such a right-leaning country, this country has needed an international and external force in order to be directed towards the correct path of righteousness. And certainly the African Union is in a very unique position to execute such a plan.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Gerald, again, for being our customized guide through these discussions and so authoritatively, and for sharing a great education with us. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
That brings us to the end of our program. Stay tuned. The Expanding Mind is up next with Eric Davis. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and let me know what you think about this program with our guest, our wonderful and dear guest, Gerald Horn, today. Until then, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow on Free Your Mind Friday. Yes. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.